Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of September. We are very pleased to have U.S. Forest Service wildlife biologist Betsy Howell back on our program again, speaking with us about surveys for Pacific martens on the Olympic National Forest. Welcome back, Betsy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, we are very happy to have you. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a great sound? It sounds like a cartoon character. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. We'd like to start the program with an addendum to last week's program. Hopefully many of you were able to catch host Mary Robson's inspiring interview with Jude Rubin and three of the students and alumni of the YES program. YES stands for Youth Environmental Stewards. Jude wanted to be sure to honor and thank all five of the participating high school programs: the Port Townsend High School, Port Townsend Ocean Program, Chimicum Pie Program, Chimicum High School, and the Quilcene High School. And we'd like to thank Jude and all of the young environmental stewards for all of their hard work on all of our behalves.
The biggest news of the week is, of course, the dramatic change in the weather. As if a switch had been flipped on Sunday, from months of sunny, dry weather, it suddenly became windy and rainy, a few days before the official start of fall on the autumnal equinox on Thursday, September 21st. It is to be hoped that this first substantial rainfall of the season will serve as an aid in the control of all of the wildfires burning in our region this summer, and finally clear the air of all of the accumulated smoke and haze.
I've just never seen such a year for smoke and haze. I mean, I've lived here almost 30 years, and it was astonishing. It just felt like the end of the world.
I know, it was really something.
So many of our breeding songbirds have left us to head south, but we still have plenty of cool birds about to keep our interest. Ron Sykes of our local Audubon chapter, Admiralty Audubon, posted on their website last week about a great field trip that they took right in our own backyard, near the Larry Scott Trail and the Kaitai Lagoon. He writes, quote, "On the West Rock Breakwater, we saw about 200 Heermann's gulls, some black turnstones, and one surfbird. Moving over to the Kaitai Lagoon, there were a variety of waterfowl and shorebirds. Standing near the bridge, we were totally surprised when we turned from the lagoon to the little pond to see why a great blue heron was loudly complaining. Then we saw floundering in the pond an osprey, and when it came out, it was, hard to believe, carrying a flounder. It headed over the wooden bridge, but could not clear the fish, which smacked into the railing. The osprey stalled, released the flounder, and headed over the lagoon, putting all the waterfowl and shorebirds into the air."
That's a great story.
It's a great story, isn't it? Thanks very much, Ron, for that. On to our main topic. In August 2016, we talked with Betsy about two species of wildlife that live on the Olympic Peninsula, the Pacific fisher and the Pacific marten. Today, we're going to focus on the marten and the recent inventory work on this species that has been done this summer and will continue next year. But before we get to that, let's refresh everyone on what a marten is. Can you tell us a little bit about them, Betsy?
Absolutely. Both martens and fishers are mammals. They belong to the Mustelid, or more commonly known as the weasel family. This is a big family. It includes river otters, wolverines, weasels, of course, skunks, badgers, minks, and the largest members of the family are sea otters and wolverines. And they're all very easily distinguishable by their long bodies and short legs and extreme energy and activity. If you've ever had a river otter move in under your house, which I know has happened in Port Townsend a few times, you know that they're very lively little creatures. Most of the species have pretty small ears and, of course, wonderful coats that made them very valuable as fur-bearing animals. They also have anal scent glands, which we know very well from the skunks, but all of them are, are very odoriferous creatures.
So what's the current situation regarding martens on the Olympic Peninsula?
Several species of mustelids were trapped pretty heavily for their fur in the 19th and early to mid-20th centuries, and this caused some pretty big declines in their populations and in some places resulted in the extirpation of the animals.
Such as extirpation of the marten's larger cousin, the fisher, right? And that led to the reintroduction of the fisher on the Olympic Peninsula a few years ago.
Yes, that is correct. In the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of work done to determine exactly what the fisher's status was in the state of Washington. And after a lot of work with remote camera survey projects and looking into old trapping records and other historical records, it was determined there were no fishers in Washington. And so that led to a number of planning efforts to bring them back to the state. And that has so far happened on the Olympic Peninsula. We were the first area to receive fishers from British Columbia.
It started in 2008 and it ran until 2010,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's correct. So 2008 through 2010, animals were actually being brought down from Canada and released into Olympic National Park.
The total was like 90
yes.
individuals.
Yes, that's correct. 90 animals. And then from 2010 to 2016, a number of different monitoring efforts were done for the fishers, including radio telemetry work and non-invasive remote camera survey work. And now all of that data are being analyzed. And then this sort of the second part of the reintroduction plan for the state of Washington now includes work in the Cascades. So,
oh, that's cool. Well, it's such an exciting project. And Betsy joined us on KPTZ a couple of years ago and talked specifically about fishers. And hopefully we will get a proper archive system set up at the station here soon, and then the radio audience will have access to all of those old programs too, because the details about that are really very exciting.
Oh, that would be great.
But back to the current Martin project.
On the peninsula, since the early 90s, there have been 7 pretty extensive remote camera survey efforts, and these have been done for some different reasons. One, of course, has been to monitor the reintroduced fisher population. The second was to assess the effects of the removal of the Elwha dams on carnivores. And then finally, to specifically try and document martens. And these different studies have been done by numerous agencies and individuals, including the park and the forest, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, the tribes, Jefferson Land Trust, the DNR. Anyway, it's been a tremendous partnership with a number of different groups. And all of this work has yielded exactly 2 remote camera photographs of a marten.
Oh.
2 stations that took remote camera photographs of martens. And both stations were in the Upper Ho watershed of the national park. And they were possibly of 2 different animals, also possibly just 1 animal. And we got those pictures in 2015 and 2016. Also in 2015, we received just coincidentally a photograph of a marten taken by a rock climber who was ascending the summit of Mount Cruiser in the southeast portion of the National Forest. So that means we've gotten 3 photographs of martens in recent years, which doubled what we'd had since 1988, which now brings us to a total of 6.
So they're pretty thin on the ground, those martens. Is that true in other parts of Washington? Are they so rare?
This is one of the many interesting questions about martens in Washington, as well as Oregon, because populations in the Cascade Mountains appear to be doing pretty well compared to the coastal populations. Martens in the Cascades are frequently recorded on remote cameras, and I pretty frequently will learn of photos being taken by the general public of curious martens that they find while hiking or even that come up on their back porches if they live out near the forest. So why martens still seem to be thriving in the Cascades but appear to be in such low numbers in the Olympics is still a really big question.
Huh. That is really odd. So are there any theories about what happened to martens here?
Well, there are certainly some ideas, but nothing that I think anybody would feel confident saying was definitive. You know, things that may have stressed the populations in the Olympics in the past or that may be doing so now include things like, at least currently, changes in the climate. Martens are very snow-adapted animals, and in recent years, as we well know, the snowpack in the Olympics has been pretty variable. And in years where we don't have a lot of snow, other predators, such as bobcats and coyotes, can get into the higher, more remote areas of the landscape, which is where we think martens might be located these days, and they can certainly have an impact on martens.
And I remember hearing a few years ago that they found that coyotes have had a great impact on the marmot population, and it's because, you know, wolves are no longer here to control coyotes, and coyotes are a relatively recent predator in our area, especially at high elevations, right?
Right. That is correct. Yeah, they are a new species to the peninsula, which is kind of interesting. You wouldn't maybe think of that.
And they're so smart and opportunistic, so they can go anywhere, do anything.
Amazingly adaptable. Yeah. And so, you know, if it's a low snow year and the marmots emerge from their hibernation and they've already got to contend with coyotes, it can definitely have an impact, and it has had an impact. So we can presume that something similar may be going on with martens, and martens are very small. I don't know that people always understand how small they are. They're generally only about 1 or 2 pounds. So
they have such a big presence that you don't think of them as being so small.
They have a very big presence and a very big tail, and but they are tiny, and there also could be other reasons. Certainly today we might be seeing, you know, the lag effects from historical overtrapping, certainly the loss of older forest habitats, which both martens and fishers rely on for certain characteristics in the forest, such as snags and downed logs for breeding habitat. You know, those things have undoubtedly affected the populations. And then finally, in the lower elevations, it's possible that rodenticides, which have become a pretty big concern in the wildlife community, are getting into the food chain and affecting carnivore populations, though that wouldn't really explain what is going on in these wilderness areas of the park and forest, where presumably rodenticides are not a problem. Mm.
So you mentioned 7 different survey efforts that have taken place in recent years. What's currently happening?
Right now, our most extensive effort for focusing primarily on martens occurred in 2016, so last year. And this was in both the National Park and the National Forest. And we had a couple of really great crews, and they installed 193 camera stations. And these were placed in the coastal habitats of the National Park and in the higher elevations of both the park and forest. And from these 193 stations and many weeks on the landscape, we obtained photographs of one marten at one camera station. Mm. But the high elevation cameras, which were placed around historic marten records, were only operating during the summer. And this was due to the many difficulties with accessing these remote, difficult places. But winter is often the very best time to survey for carnivores. So this summer we're trying something different, and that is to install long-term lure dispensers.
Mm. So what exactly are these dispensers and how do they work?
So long-term lure dispensers are systems that can be left out for several months on the landscape without needing any maintenance. And so they're basically ideal for operating in inaccessible areas throughout the winter. And these dispensers, the whole system was designed by Robert Long and Paula McKay of the Woodland Park Zoo. And they worked in collaboration with engineers from Microsoft Research, as well as the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. And the basic idea with this dispenser is that it's a 28-ounce hydration bag, like the kind you buy at REI. Mm. And it's filled with a liquid lure attractant for carnivores. And it's basically a pretty smelly combination of various substances that attract carnivores and other animals.
Your dog would like to roll in, would love to roll in if they only had opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So what they did with Microsoft and the dispenser was to rig up a little tiny computer inside of this weatherproof box, which would be programmed to dispense 3 milliliters of the liquid on a daily basis. And the dispenser box is hung in a tree, and it sits just above a bone, so there's sort of a visual attractant too for the animal, and then the liquid is dispensed onto the bone. And so you've got that smell carrying in the air, draw the animal in, sees the bone, crawls up the tree, and then on a nearby tree is
then
placed...
You snap a camera.
Put a camera, exactly. And the camera has a very large memory card, 32 gigabytes, so it can hold thousands of photos, runs on lithium batteries, which do very well in the cold and can operate for a very long time. And Robert and Paula have used these setups for their wolverine work in the Cascades, and they've had really good success having them out for an entire year, and they still work, and they've been able to document the target species, which is the wolverine, but they've also got martens, lynx, I think a wolf as well. The dispensers and the cameras have to be hung up above, where the snow is going to accumulate. But then they're set up for the winter and they're good to go.
Oh, that's great. So those are different from what you've used before in the remote camera surveys.
Yes, they are. Generally, the cameras we've set up before, they have been installed with bait and lure, as these new ones are. But the lure, and the bait for that matter, is something that we put out at the beginning. We hope that the lure will remain sort of fresh during the time in between checks, but nothing new happens until the surveyor returns at the next check, which is generally after a couple of weeks. We add more lure, but depending on the weather, the sight may or may not be very, or the scent may or may not be very strong during that intervening period. So you will affect, how many animals know about the station and come in. The other difference, too, is that the cameras set up for the fisher monitoring were done during the spring, summer, and fall, which was largely, and not during the winter, which was largely about safety and accessibility. So they weren't perhaps at the optimal time. And then the surveys that we did with a citizen science organization in 2013 and 2014, targeting specifically marten and in the National Forest, we did set those stations up during the winter, but again, because of accessibility, they were still mostly at lower elevations.
Mm-hmm. And these new long-term dispensers have now been installed in the Olympics?
Yes, they have. So this summer, Paula and Robert joined the Olympic Marten Partnership, and they came over and installed 4 of the lure dispensers and cameras in the National Forest. And during one of those trips, crew from Olympic National Park came along as well, did 2 days of training with Paul and Robert, and then the crew later installed another 2 dispensers in the park. So we've got a total of 6 that will go into this winter. And the dispensers here are definitely going to be something of a test, just because I think the challenges are going to be a little different looking for martens as opposed to looking for wolverines. Martens, again, they're much smaller animals, and they don't have as large of home ranges, and they don't travel as far as wolverines. So some of Paula and Robert's Cascade stations didn't document wolverines until some weeks after their installation, which, showed that having a ready source of attractant for an animal that may not come by until long after the humans have been there is a really great thing for an animal that ranges widely. At the moment, we just don't know what we're dealing with for population size and distribution of the martens here. So how well will the site work if the marten is, if the marten's travel routes are just outside the area? Of the lure dispenser. I mean, we just don't know. There are lots of unknowns.
That's what science is about. A lot of times you just do your best in designing something and you see what happens. So what if no martens are detected?
We just received word that grant money we had applied for back in the late winter for additional Olympic Martin survey work was approved for next year. So that's for 2018, right? And this will include additional dispenser stations and also the use of scent detection dogs. And scent or scat detection dogs are dogs that have been trained to specifically search for certain scats of wildlife species, and in this case it would be martens and probably fishers and possibly a couple other carnivores as well. And Paula and Robert have a lot of experience with dogs as well, as does Katie Moriarty, who works with the PNW Research Station in Corvallis. And Katie has been using dogs to find scats of martens in coastal Oregon, where the animals' numbers are also low and the populations seem disconnected. So here, initially, the dogs will likely only be used in the national forest because of restrictions on dogs in the national park. But the dispenser work will take place in both park and forest. And, you know, we'll just have to see what we learn from these survey efforts and then determine the next steps. I think what's really exciting and encouraging is that the technology is evolving in some really interesting ways.
Yeah.
And really, you know, efficient
and non-invasive ways
too. And non-invasive, yeah. And that has proven successful too. So we'll just have to see what we find out.
So would one of the possibilities be to reintroduce Martin to the Olympic Peninsula in the same way that fishers were?
Well, you know, that's certainly a question I get asked a fair bit. I think that it's something that people are thinking about, and I think at this time, though, we still feel like we want to know a little bit more about what's going on. The Fisher reintroduction went forward because it was determined, to the best of everyone's understanding, there were no Fishers mm-hmm. remaining in the state of Washington. And we know that as of at least last August, we had at least one Martin uh-huh. on the peninsula. Now, even if we find that we have Martins, but they're at such a low density, you know, it could be a tool in the toolbox, but it's pretty early to say if that will happen.
Well, you don't want to be hasty with reintroductions. We hopefully have learned enough from our past mistakes to know that we need to keep our hands off as much as possible unless it's clear that we need to do something.
And it's so important to understand what exactly is the cause and effect too of a species declining. So there will be more to the story.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming in to share that with us.
And thank you.
And we will hope to get you back in a year or so to let us know.
I would love it.
And hopefully there will be lots of Martins recorded. And anyway, time will tell.
Yes.
Thanks
yes.
a lot.
Thank you.
We have a bunch of great natural history events to tell you about. And first off, join the Jefferson Land Trust for what should be a really fun work party this Saturday, September 23rd. Come help them build benches for local nature preserves so that people of all ages and all levels of mobility can enjoy trails and green spaces. You don't have to have any carpentry skills to help out. Go to saveland.org for more information.
Also, on Saturday, September 23rd, join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon chapter on a field trip from Pitship Pocket to Port Williams, looking for our returning coastal birds. Go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for details.
Admiralty Audubon, our local Port Townsend Audubon chapter, also has a work party next weekend. Join them to help clean up the area south of the Kaitai Lagoon on Sunday morning, September 24th. And maybe you'll see the osprey. You just never know. Go to admiraltyaudubon.org for details on where to meet.
And also on Sunday, September 24th, head over to the Fall Native Plant Sale at the H.J. Carroll Park from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It is a benefit for the Cool Kahan Native Plant Demonstration Garden, and a wide variety of Pacific Northwest native plant species will be available for sale, from trees to grasses.
And finally, our Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society has planned a field trip to view the fall colors at Mount Rainier next Wednesday and Thursday, September 27th and 28th. Go to their website at wnps.org and search for the Olympic chapter for details and contact info. And here's our mystery sound again. It's a Heerman's gull. One of our local naturalists, Jeff Gibson, dubbed them the Mexican laughing gull in a recent post, which seems very apt. He's been seeing them hanging out in great numbers, up to 100 strong, on the roof of the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, and turning their roof white with all the droppings. And Betsy, it's one of Betsy's favorite
you
birds,
know,
too.
You know, I love the Heerman's gulls, and I do see them at the Marine Science Center a lot, and I just always feel like they're just telling a lot of jokes and just laughing at their jokes.
Well, I don't know them very well, you know, because they're just here for a relatively brief period, you know, in the midsummer to the fall. And I listened to the recording and it just made me chuckle too, just to hear them.
Yeah, they're fabulous.
Yeah. So, and they're really handsome gulls. They have bright red bills. They really can be confused with nothing else in our area. They have bright red bills tipped with black, with the breeding adults sporting a white head against a light gray rump and underparts, and a black tail with a white tip. And we usually see the adults in non-breeding plumage up in our area with their head is gray instead, or as juveniles or subadults. They take, I think, a full three years to get into their adult plumage. And when they're juveniles or subadults, they appear to be a uniform dark brown with a yellowish black-tipped bill. So in late May, after their early breeding season, Heerman's gulls migrate north along the Pacific coast. Their migration coincides with that of the brown pelican, from whom they often steal food. They arrive in the Northwest in midsummer and stay through the fall, when they return to Mexico to breed. They are generally quite gregarious, hence the group of 200 that Ron Sykes saw near Larry Scott Trail last week, and the group of 100 that Jeff saw roosting at the Marine Science Center. So chances are good that you will see them if you keep your eyes peeled while walking our local shorelines this fall.
Excellent.
Yes. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the third week of September. Thanks very much for joining me, Betsy, and to all of you for listening. As always, happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Sunny Flores.